From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, a new era for India, as early election results show a landslide victory for the Hindu nationalist Prime Minister in waiting.
Modi has promised a hell of a lot, and he's under tremendous pressure to deliver, and deliver very quickly, because over the last 5 years, people have lost patience and they want things to happen instantly.
Also today, as a UN report warns of the dire human rights situation in Ukraine, Russia releases its own list of violations. And 60 years since Brown versus Board, are America's students still segregated?
Brown v. Board of Education was both a moral and a legal imperative. It said to the country that separate facilities in education were inherently unequal.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The opposition Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, is projected to win India's elections in a landslide. It's the most decisive win for any party in the last 3 decades, with the BJP thoroughly outing the ruling Congress. Narendra Modi will be India's new prime minister. He's promising economic growth for the country. The BJP says its win is a people's victory. Congress Vice President Rahul Gandhi acknowledged his and his party's resounding defeat.
Congress party has done pretty badly. There's a lot for us to think about. And as Vice President of the party, I hold myself responsible for what has happened.
Protests continue in Soma, Turkey, following the explosion at a coal mine that killed hundreds. Police forces have now shot tear gas, water cannons, and rubber bullets at thousands of people who came out to demonstrate. Protesters are shouting anti-government rhetoric, blaming officials for their lack of action in ensuring the safety of the coal mine and for poor response to the crisis. The Soma Mining Company admitted today that they have no idea what caused the accident. And as Laura Wells reports from Turkey, they also revealed they did not have safety precautions in place.
They admitted they did not have any safe rooms for miners in case of an accident. This is something the CEO had bragged about earlier. He said they were in the process of building one, and it would be completed in 3 to 4 months. But it had not yet even been started built. Those miners had nothing but gas masks, which would last 45 minutes.
California firefighters say they expect more challenging conditions as they continue to tackle dangerous wildfires in the south of the state. A badly burned body has been found in Carlsbad, north of San Diego, the first apparent victim of the intense flames. California correspondent Rebecca Bowring reports.
Crews checking hotspots found a scorched body in an encampment but couldn't confirm fire was the cause of death. At least 125,000 people have fled their homes in the San Diego area, and seasonably early wildfires have burned huge tracts of land and continue to threaten communities north of the city. 2,500 firefighters are battling the blazes with water-dropping aircraft. Unpredictable winds have caused fast-moving swirls of flames dubbed firenados. 9 fires erupted all over the county last weekend, and 2 teenagers have been arrested on arson-related charges.
Legendary American broadcaster Barbara Walters made her last appearance on daytime TV today after 52 years on air. 2 high-profile guests, Hillary Clinton and Oprah Winfrey, joined the 84-year-old Walters on her final appearance to bid her adieu. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. United Nations monitors have issued a statement claiming violence by anti-government groups in eastern Ukraine is threatening human rights as the political crisis between pro-Russian separatists and Kiev continues. Patrice Howard reports from UN headquarters in New York.
The UN report covered the period from April 2nd to May 6th. It said police and local authorities in eastern Ukraine participated in illegal acts, like infiltrating towns with armed groups. The report also cited a wave of abductions and unlawful detentions of journalists, activists, politicians, and military personnel. UN Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay said in a statement that the report also raised concern about the harassment of minorities in Crimea. Russia called the findings politically motivated and non-objective.
The U.S. State Department is warning Americans about the heightened risks of travel to Kenya. The warning was issued just hours before two bombs exploded in a market in the capital city of Nairobi. Our Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff reports.
The U.S. State Department flatly states that violent criminal attacks can happen at any time in Kenya, especially in the capital of Nairobi. Kenyan police are suspecting improvised explosive devices in the two fatal bomb attacks in the Nairobi market. Issued just hours before that attack, the U.S. travel warning highlights the heightened threats of terrorism in Kenya. In fact, American diplomats have had their travel restricted in the capital following recent events. The warning now advises American tourists to keep these restrictions in mind, although noting popular tourist areas are relatively safe, as long as they use common sense precautions.
The UK has issued a similar warning and is evacuating hundreds of British tourists back home from the Kenyan coast. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The Hindu nationalist BJP party says India is beginning a new era as it wins what looks set to be a landslide general election victory. According to votes counted so far, the BJP will win the first parliamentary majority in India since 1984. After a decade of governing by the Congress Party, India's new Prime Minister will be Narendra Modi. Mr. Modi has promised to develop India's economy and speed up slowing growth. For more on what the change at the top of Indian politics will mean for relations between Washington and New Delhi, I spoke to India-based journalist Rahul Bedi.
The BJP, the right-wing Hindu Nationalist Party, has managed to secure a majority in Parliament on its own. It was earliestly presumed that it would fall short of the magic number of 272, which is required in the 543-member Parliament for any party to rule. And it was assumed that BJP would need a lot of allies, but it doesn't. But along with its allies, it secured almost 340 seats, which is a record. And no single party has secured a majority like this in the last 30 years. So it's quite a phenomenon that has taken place.
Rahul, can you remind us what the pillars of Mr. Modi's campaign were?
Well, Mr. Modi ran a very high-tech, sophisticated, tech-savvy campaign, in which he promised what everybody was really looking for is employment, economic development, infrastructure development, corruption-free administration, all the things that the outgoing Congress government was unable to provide, because the Congress government for the last 5 years was rife with corruption scandals, inefficiency, malgovernance, and the cost of doing business in India and the cost of doing commerce in India was so expensive because of the corruption aspect that everybody was very disillusioned. And Modi has promised to right all that and make things work.
So is this a sign, do you think, of a huge political and potentially economic shift for India?
Well, it could be, because if the stock markets are anything to go by, they registered stock markets over the last week or so in anticipation of Modi's victory have gone up about 5%, and they went up another percentage point today. And the value of the Indian rupee against the U.S. dollar, which had gone up over the last 10 months, in fact, dropped. So the Indian rupee, the dollar has become cheaper to buy for Indians. This is indicative of better times to come, because according to financial analysts, a lot of investors are waiting to invest in India. And it seems that India is on the verge of turning the economic milestone.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it remains to be seen, because Modi has promised a hell of a lot.
Right.
And he's under tremendous pressure to deliver, and deliver very quickly, because over the last 5 years, people have lost patience and they want things to happen instantly.
What will this result mean for the relationship between Washington and New Delhi? Because Mr. Modi has had a controversial past, which at one point led to the US actually denying him a visa.
Well, not only the U.S., but most European Union countries too had boycotted him for the last decade. And it's only in the last few months when he'd been nominated the prime ministerial candidate for the BJP did they actually approach him. This was because of his questionable role in the 2002 riots which took place, in which about 1,000 people, mostly Muslims, died, and he was accused of conniving in this what is being called in the Indian media as the Muslim pogrom. But I think Mr. Modi, it seems, is a very practical man, and he looks at development and commerce before he looks at anything else. I don't think he has any room for emotion, and I think he will be very pragmatic in his dealings with not only the U.S., but also with the Europeans, and also in India's neighborhood, particularly countries like China and Japan, to which he has already started making overtures as Chief Minister of Gujarat State. And it's expected that this relationship will progress over the next few years that he is Prime Minister.
India-based journalist Rahul Bedi, and our apologies for the slight interference on that phone line. This is FSN Reports. Brown versus Board of Education shifted the legal and moral compass of our nation. That from President Obama's resolution on the 1954 ruling. Saturday marks 60 years since the Supreme Court threw out the Jim Crow ideology of separate but equal, affecting everything from segregated schools to voting rights. But as Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten told FSN's Alice Olstein, American students are still segregated by race and money.
Brown was a legal and a moral imperative to educate all of our kids. And it did in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, by a 9-0 vote, the Warren Court, did something huge, which was to say separate is not inherently equal, and that we need to have equal access to a great education. The court relied upon state after state to do something, and many states didn't. We, frankly, as a union, did a lot more than many states. We, as a union, expelled our segregated locals and lost many members as a result of it. Then, after the Civil Rights Act, that's when the federal government got involved and engaged in trying to bring forward and help with the integration orders. The federal government has walked away from using integration as a tool to solve de facto segregation. To solve de facto segregation, one has to actually look at housing patterns, one has to look at demographics, one has to look at economics, and there is such polarization in this country, even over things like, do we raise the minimum wage? Do we help people who are unemployed get back on their feet? So I think that we have, to be effective for kids that are in schools right now, we have to have a different strategy. The strategy we're undertaking is how we help create great neighborhood public schools, and working with community and labor and parents and clergy to make that a reality. And that's our strategy to reclaim the promise of public education. Well-prepared and supported teachers with tools to help kids, like lower class size and time to collaborate so that they really understand things like the new Common Core, engaging curriculum, including art and music, AP courses, extracurricular activities, and things like wraparound services, including early childhood education, and ensuring that kids have the nutritious meals they need and have eyeglasses to see a board, and making sure that they have safe places after school.
And where in the country is there still so much separation and inequality, and what can we learn from those cities?
Well, what we're seeing is that the North has become more segregated, or our schools have become more segregated than the South. But we've also learned that our country has become very multiracial. When Brown became the law of the land, it was a black-white issue. Now when you look at schools, the most emerging majority in schools is our Latino brothers and sisters. So we have a country that's changing, and we're asking public education to do much, much more with less. So the one thing we have to stop doing is we have to stop demonizing the teachers, the people who are closest to kids, and we have to give them the tools that they need to help kids succeed in a global economy, help kids be prepared for life and citizenship, for career and college. So this is about fixing, not closing, neighborhood schools, and it's about teaching, not testing.
You mentioned the school closings that have been happening in Chicago and Philadelphia, right here in Washington, D.C. How does that fit into this separate but not equal issue?
Parents, when you ask them, of course they want a great neighborhood public school. So rather than superintendents saying, let's close that school instead, fix it. Work with teachers, our unions, communities, to get the resources in that we need. Don't pretend that they don't exist in the greatest country in the world.
There has been a lot of discussion about which schools are being closed, and has this exacerbated the diversity issue?
Absolutely. And so, you know, when you see schools in Chicago, for example, school upon school upon school in the inner city being closed, what does that do to neighborhoods? It just hollows neighborhoods out. It escalates the instability of a neighborhood. So why would we do that to the inner city? Why would we do that to a rural area? It is a stopgap solution that's really no solution at all.
Brown versus Board of Education was about racial inequality and separation, and today we're seeing a lot of the achievement gaps in education correlating a lot towards income and socioeconomic status. Do we need to refocus the diversity efforts on that sort of economic diversity?
So right now we have economic inequality, the likes of which we haven't had since the Great Depression. It crosses race lines, but it disproportionately affects African American and Hispanic families. What we need to do is focus like a laser on the schools that don't work, but also make sure that we revitalize public education, because it is an anchor of democracy. It is a pillar of pluralism. It is the propeller of economy. It is a unique American institution that promises universal access and fights for universal attainment.
Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten talking to FSN's Alice Olstein. Now, a new HIV prevention and control bill passed in Uganda has been strongly criticised by rights campaigners as a backward step in the fight against AIDS. The legislation criminalises anyone who knowingly transmits the virus and can lead to a hefty fine and a 10-year prison sentence. FSN's Leon Senyange reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
The controversial HIV/AIDS prevention and control bill criminalises intentional and attempted HIV transmission. Chris Bariomusi, a Ugandan member of parliament, says there was a need for new legislation.
We needed to supplement the interventions with an enabling law. Some countries began with legislation and then implementation of programs, but then they didn't know what it takes to address HIV/AIDS.
A clause in the bill prescribes a maximum 10 years in jail, a fine of over $1,900 or both for anyone who intentionally transmits HIV/AIDS to another person. And it has been welcomed by many.
If it is not intentional, that is okay. But if it's intentional, then I support the legislators.
I think they would have given them a harder punishment, like life imprisonment.
The bill also requires medical workers to disclose the status of HIV-positive people without their consent. Parents, too, will be compelled to reveal their status to their children. Lillian Moreko, an HIV/AIDS activist, however, says government should provide more services to deal with HIV.
We cannot deal with an epidemic with a law, with a legislation, but we can only deal with the epidemic the way we've been doing it, by scaling up the services. And therefore, coming up with a law that has such clauses, for God's sake, we are creating a situation, an environment that is going to be, you know, chaotic. Because how are you going to tell that there was attempted transmission?
Even with Uganda's HIV campaigns over the last decade emphasizing abstinence, being faithful and condom use, a National AIDS Indicator survey in 2011 showed HIV prevalence rates in the country had increased with over 130,000 new infections annually. Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni has until August to sign the bill into law. Leon Senyange, Kampala.
Finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, the segment of the show that takes an in-depth look at a story you might have missed. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, Brazil. We are inevitably going to be hearing a lot more about it in the weeks ahead as the country prepares to host the Soccer World Cup, then in 2 years' time, the Olympic Games. Brazil today is at a turning point, a rising power increasingly occupying a front row seat at the world's table and demanding more as its economy continues to soar. Harold Trincunas, director of the Latin America Initiative at the Brookings Institution, has just published a new report called Brazil's Rise: Seeking Influence in Global Governance. He told Fred Dews that the country stands at a crossroads in its bid for major power status.
Brazil has a choice in the sense that it's on the cusp of achieving that major power status. It has unprecedented opportunities during the past decade to insert itself into global governance in a way that it's really been seeking to do for at least 100 years. I mean, one of the things the report documents is the fact that Brazil has been seeking to influence global governance at least since its participation in World War I and Versailles afterwards and the peace negotiations that followed that war. But Brazil basically seeks to become one of the countries that participates in shaping the rules governing the global order. But what that means for Brazil in terms of the kind of world it would like to see is a world where the rules of global order tread very lightly on country sovereignty. Brazil is a country that believes in sovereignty, equality among nations, non-intervention in each other's political affairs, in the rule of international law, that these should be the dominant factors guiding global governance. And this, on the one hand, puts it at odds with some of the more interventionist countries in the international system, but it also differentiates it from some of the more authoritarian countries as well. So Brazil is in this very interesting middle position in terms of the kind of world it envisions, even as it rises in terms of its economy and other kinds of power to really become more influential.
Is there a tension there between wanting to influence the rules but also holding fast to the priority of sovereignty and non-intervention?
Absolutely. And this is one of the unresolved issues that Brazil faces as it becomes a more influential country in the international system. And it's something that it is still feeling its way through. If you look at the way Brazil has participated in managing recent international crises such as the global financial crises or the intervention in Libya or negotiations over global climate change, Brazil has very much had to play off on this tension between wanting to be at the table, helping to set the rules, and trying to make sure those rules respect national sovereignty as much as possible.
So last year, Edward Snowden revealed that the National Security Agency was monitoring the phones of various world leaders, including Germany's Angela Merkel, and as we found out, President Dilma Rousseff of Brazil. She canceled her summit with President Obama last year, and then she called for a kind of an internet connection that would bypass the United States. Can you talk about how Brazil and other nations in the region are thinking about internet governance?
Brazil has really taken the lead on this in the region, but also globally speaking. They're one of the major countries that have focused on the implications of the Snowden affair for global internet governance. Specifically on the Snowden revelations, President Rousseff was not just motivated by the traditional Brazilian concerns over sovereignty, which we already discussed are very important to Brazil, but also because those revelations came at a politically sensitive time for President Rousseff. I mean, she was in the year before presidential elections in which she is running for a second term. President Rousseff is also somebody who in her earlier life experienced surveillance by the military government in Brazil when she was a guerrilla and insurgent against the military government back in the 60s and 70s. So she has her own sort of personal and political reasons for opposing this, as well as Brazilian state reasons for opposing this kind of surveillance. Brazil, most recently in the Net Mundial conference that just concluded in Brazil, came down on the side of multi-stakeholder governance, by which they mean the inclusion of civil society and the private sector along with governments in making decisions about how internet is governed, as long as it was decentered from the United States, as long as some of the institutions such as ICANN sort of detached themselves more from the United States and became more global. It understands that the way of managing the global internet that has developed so far, which is this multi-stakeholder approach, is an effective way of managing the internet. But it does want to correct what it sees as some of the problems, this kind of close attachment to the United States, by making it more of an international management process.
So in Brazil last year, I believe, there were some widespread protests throughout the country. What was driving those issues and the movement behind it? Where is it now? And how is that kind of playing into President Rousseff's reelection campaign?
It's going to become an issue again this summer because the protests, which died down in the last few months, are likely to come back during the World Cup games that are taking place in Brazil in June and July. The original protests, which were sparked by concerns over the cost of transportation, but more generally over the cost of living, capture part of this middle class anxiety that we discussed earlier, where people feel that the cost of living, poor government services, and problems with public safety, for example, are all sources of concern for them as middle class, and also something that the government should be doing more about. In Brazil, this combined with concerns over the amount of money that the government was spending to prepare for these major international sporting events, such as the World Cup in 2014 and the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro. So it really became part of a broader critique of how the government was spending its money and how the government is managing public policy. And while this died down in the last few since last summer, the reason I say it's likely to come back is because the World Cup is really going to shine much more focused media spotlight on Brazil, and activists in Brazil understand that and see that as an opportunity to pressure the government to achieve some gains on their demands.
Harold Trincunas, director of the Latin America Initiative at the Brookings Institution. And you can read his report on Brazil at the institution's website, brookings.org. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Monday, the civic duty of the international luxury goods sector.
You know, the sad thing about the fashion industry in particular is things come in and out of fashion. You know, it's kind of what we're good at. One season, fur is fashionable, the next season it isn't. And I think the reality is to be sustainable and responsible in business needs to be continuous.
That's Monday, but for now I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.